8 removes, to some extent, the incentive of a government to try create the surplus in its own economy to get basically a taxation base. So it definitely is an incentive not to raise taxes. And so we should never forget that 8 to start with has a negative incentive. So we always have to prove that we can do better than that negative incentive.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks, a series of interviews with leading policy practitioners and economists around the world. My name is Tim Phillips, and today I'm speaking to Stefan Dirkhorn, a professor of economic policy at the Blavatnik School of Government. Between 2011 and 2017, Stefan was chief economist at the Department for International Development, the government department that's in charge of the UK's aid policy and spending. In this position, he was responsible for ensuring the use of evidence in the agency's decision-making, often in situations in which there was little data available, or when judgments had to be made quickly. Stefan, the way in which aid agencies make these decisions has recently become a political hot topic. Is this fair?
The whole principle of questioning aid effectiveness can only be a good thing. We should not simply take for granted that the mere fact of giving some aid to a place, a situation, a group of people that has needs is necessarily an effective way of using your resources. What is really frustrating is, of course, if the questioning of the effectiveness of aid is done on the basis of very poor evidence or very selective evidence. So debate is wonderful. Learning about how to do this better is very important. But just arguing for the sake of argument based on very little evidence is not very helpful. So I would add to that, when one questions whether aid is effective, sometimes it's actually just the same as one would question that a government is not effective. If aid is provided, say, to the Indian government, one works with them within their imperfections to do as good as one can to try to improve a little bit how the system works and then try to actually reach people. What one wants to make sure is that actually the benefits outweigh the costs of what is being delivered. And in a lot of the discussions of aid effectiveness, it's kind of forgotten what one is actually trying to do. One is trying to add some resources and one hopes that the benefits there are well outweighing some of the costs. And that's a good criterion. A lot of the stories that are being told about it, they don't even give us any flavor of whether indeed the costs were outweighing the benefits or that the benefits were outweighing the costs. But debate, always a good thing.
How much do we really know about the effectiveness of aid at the moment compared to what we knew maybe 10 years, 20, 40 years ago?
Just as we know much more about the spending of government budgets in the UK compared 30, 40, 50 years ago, we know also massively more about the effectiveness of our financial flows going to particular countries, to particular programs, and whether they are changing and impacting on lives. We probably used to think that every penny we were to spend in a particular country would be effective without any knowledge, maybe purely based on trust. We've now definitely learned much more about how to not take for granted that aid is effective, just as we shouldn't take for granted that money spent by the Indian or the Ethiopian government is necessarily effective, just as we don't take for granted that what Oxford City Council spent is effective per se. So we learn to do much better beforehand to assess whether what they want to do with the money is actually going to be impactful. We know better how to monitor whether it's from a fiduciary, yes, or basically whether the money is not used for other purposes or indeed just for implementation and an efficiency of the programs. And we spend much more money these days on evaluating, not simply sending someone out and asking the Ethiopian, Rwandan, Indian government or indeed Oxford City Council whether they think they spent the money wisely, but actually on the ground, testing, evaluating, measuring whether this money is being spent more. We're learning, and sometimes these things are not perfectly done. But just as the public doesn't want to take us for granted, implementing agencies can't take it for granted either, and we're learning a lot more. Can I say aid is effective or not? Well, it all depends. There are some wonderful projects with very high effectiveness that we can prove. There's some things that we probably, with the benefit of hindsight, now know, maybe not the best ones. One of the good things I definitely observed working in DFID is that we will rarely do ever a program where we know from evidence available that it will be a waste of money. So it's actually one of the great things in which evidence is used these days. It will definitely stop us from doing really silly things.
Well, that's one of the criticisms that people make, that there are zombie programs that just carry on because they've always been done. And you're saying, really, that's not true.
Within a government system, just as in the private sector, there is definitely sometimes some issues there of do we close programs down quickly enough and so on. But overall, I think definitely in terms of starting programs, it is actually pretty hard to start something these days in this community. You know, people are questioning much more, and correctly so, whether this is the thing to do, what is the evidence telling us. Now, there is another part to it. We're working in relatively fast-changing, very messy, very difficult environments sometimes. The lessons from the past don't easily translate to what you're doing at that moment there. And something I used to definitely say as chief economist is that easily 95% of the things I'm asked advice on, I don't really have a clear evidence base to base my judgment on. You have to kind of try to get a judgment of the bits and pieces one knows and saying, does this make sense to do? Is this really the best way of doing? Is it worth trying to do this? Where sometimes there are things we have really good evidence and we can do them. But in general, we don't quite have that. Now, the important thing there is, and I think we can still improve an awful lot, do we learn enough while we're doing them? Do we have enough feedback loops that we learn quickly and enough that this may not be perfect? It's quite interesting because you'll say, oh, researchers would say, surely we should research all the time than doing it. Now, that's one of the problems with research. Research usually takes a long time, and they will tell us 5 years after the program is closed that probably this wasn't a good idea. And so finding a stronger, quicker feedback loop while we're implementing programs, I think that would probably be the next frontier of increasing some of these effectiveness. But on balance, I would definitely not saying is that money is spent ever frivolously. Does it mean always the right things are done? I can't guarantee it, because this is a very data-poor environment to make the trade-offs carefully and sensibly. But I think rarely a program will be done where the evidence would say, don't do this.
One of the challenges that we're facing in the near future is that aid has to be brought to the messiest, the most difficult environments, the places where you have least information and where evaluating what's doing is most complicated.
So it's a really interesting question. In fact, it's actively debated by some academics very involved on the policy side. I know also in DFID at the moment. It's like two choices that you have. We have the best evidence, typically actually of places that are making reasonably well progress, that are institutionally not in a total mess, where actually we know about things that we could do. Now, that would be very safe bets, but arguably some people would say, well, but that's not the places necessarily with the highest need. If you simply want to spend the money where you know that the contribution to the life of a poor person is highest, you probably ended up in spending it in some middle-income countries where there's still some poverty, but actually they could probably afford to do it themselves, where the institutions are there. But, you know, there's some real good things that we can still do. Alternatively, and other people would make the choice, no, we should be doing aid, especially in the places where the need is clearly highest, that are quite messy, that are maybe countries that are, as we call them, fragiles, you know, where political situation is unstable, where accountability is not at its best, where conflict may well be raging, where people really are suffering arguably most, and there is a real deep suffering there. But of course, these are harder places to spend. So DFID, for over the last 10 years more and more, has politically made a choice we should be in these more messy places. These are the places where we think in the next 15 years most extreme poor people will be living, because in some of these slightly better places like the Indias of the world, poverty is going down quite fast, and arguably the capabilities of a government and the resource of a government are probably there that they could do it probably more and more by themselves, and we get pushed into much more these messy places. Again then, the evidence is harder. A little bit of evidence there has a very high return, but these are the places that researchers don't easily go to. And so you're sitting in this bit of a vicious cycle. But it is indeed the case that it was easier to spend aid in the past in some of these more stable places. I would definitely say it's much easier to spend aid in India or in Western China, where there's still about 80 million poor people, or in Indonesia, where there's definitely still pockets of deep poverty, than it is where most of the poor people, the highest concentrations are, like the Democratic Republic of Congo, or indeed northern Nigeria, or Sierra Leone, or southern Sudan. But it's these choices. I support this choice to working more in these difficult places. I think a development agency like DFID should be willing to go to these places and lead on this. But it does create much more tensions of how to do the aid most effectively.
And as a political choice, it's an easier political choice to send aid to places where you can more easily demonstrate that it is quickly having an effect. Have you witnessed those political choices being made?
That has often been worrying people inside and outside the organization. I will emphasize these are fair choices, because if we know for certain something has an impact, or something we don't know very well whether it would have an impact, but there's a lot of need, go for some of these low-hanging fruits, let's just grab them. That's a fair choice, and it's not necessarily a wrong ethical choice. So you have that vigorously debated. You know, we do know, we have far more evidence, for example, on certain health interventions. Even though health systems and governance, all these things matter as well, there is some kind of fairly technical, clear relationship. You know, if you manage to get a vaccine one way or another into a village, the child is vaccinated forever. There's nothing equivalent, say, in education. So you end up working much more with, dare I say, the mess that you need to work with for certain interventions than for other things. You would argue for people that say, well, is it really good enough to just work on the health for a big development agency, a leading part in the global architecture, that we actually don't do it on education, even though we know it's harder, let alone on state building, accountability, citizens' participation, that are even murkier things where the evidence base is weaker. So which choices do we make? So yes, I've seen them all the time because they're vigorously debated. The moral standing of this argument can be debated. But say, you know, a really conflict-affected place, well, maybe you just do certain things that you can't take away from people ever, even if the system collapses. So maybe it is then a better choice to use the evidence that you have and say, look, if I get a child vaccinated, if I get a girl for a couple of years in education, you can never take it away from these children again. But meanwhile, we haven't built a state. But say, well, maybe we can't do that. While other people said, look, if you don't try to build that state, the next generation of girls will still not be able to go to school and to get vaccinated. And to be honest, you know, I'm more or less describing the conundrum that, say, an agency like DFID had. And the evidence can maybe steer you to something, but you need to make these choices because, you know, there is a logic to each of these decisions. These become then moral choices, maybe our politicians make them. But people should understand that if you then make the choice for, say, let's try this state building a little bit and throw some money at it, that unsavory things may happen.
Yes, because if you look at some of your academic colleagues and the work that they do, the frameworks that they put around how aid can be delivered and should be delivered, and you read their work, which is very popular now, a lot of it is irreconcilable. It's cash transfers, it's institutions. Maybe aid itself is the problem, is some arguments. Now, as an economist who has to decide how to give aid, how do you make choices when balancing this, or is it inevitably going to be subjective?
I would definitely not ever say it is subjective. You know, it's still, you, even if you have to make choices based on more qualitative arguments, it still has to be a rational argument. A good thing is still to try to do this in a, you know, some kind of cost-benefit framework, even if I can't fully quantify the costs and the benefits, but to make sure that the debate at least happens at that level. Now, the big problem with some of the proponents of all these things is that these areas are often complementary. For example, like take someone like an important thinker like Esther Duflo, who, of course, goes for a very particular thing. A what works kind of thing, you know, let's do the things that we know we have the evidence, and let's try to invest in these things. She would say you can do an awful lot of good things, good policies, in very bad environments. And probably it's true. But people that say, you know, institutions matter, they probably have a very clear case to make, because actually, in due course, getting a much more cost-effective way and a continuation of that vaccine delivery will require somehow progress on the institutions. They all have a truth within them, and it's not incompatible with each other, but actually it's more complementary. Having said that, you then still sit with certain choices. And for example, even the people who say aid is the problem, as they do, they're probably overstating it. But we shouldn't, for example, forget, and that's another thing that I always found very important to tell, is that where the international community collectively gave quite high percentage of GDP or high percentage of government budgets, essentially in the form of aid, not necessarily to these governments, we create very strange incentives for accountability. It is, in a way, not very different from discovering oil. It's basically a small group of people that can control how these are being used. With oil, we know this is a real issue. How can we get this small group, the government, whoever is in power, not to just use that resource just for their own good? And how can we make sure there is a citizen's contract that actually it is used for the common good? Aid removes, to some extent, the incentive of a government to try create the surplus in its own economy to get basically a taxation base. So it definitely is an incentive not to raise taxes. And so we should never forget that aid to start with has a negative incentive. So we always have to prove that we can do better than that negative incentive. We had a bit of a rule of thumb internally in saying, you know, once we get into, say, 20% of GDP, we should get really worried and we should really be thinking about it. Or alternatively, start saying, once you're getting some of these high flows in, if we don't have a collective with the international community work on the tax base and creating the incentives internally that taxes were raised, which incidentally other researchers like Tim Besley and others have strongly argued is the basis of the beginnings of accountability in societies. Now, if you don't use aid for that, then you definitely make an error. I kind of rather see it more eclectic. You know, all these people with these extreme views, maybe they're selling books. I know quite a few of these. Most of them are quite reasonable. And actually, there's elements that are really helpful there. From those people who do it all based on very narrow randomized controlled trials and building up from the evidence base, they've definitely helped in DFID. At the same time, people like Acemoglu and Robinson, so Jim Robinson would often come into DFID, have definitely provided a really worthwhile long-term vision that if we don't build these institutions, we don't have a basis of ever leaving these countries and getting these countries to stand on their own feet. And it's one of the advantages working in the policy environment. You can pick the good things and think a lot about the complementarities.
One of the criticisms of aid agencies is that they are too tactical. And one of the things that you did at DFID was to create the economic development strategy. Why did you do that?
One of the criticisms that you could definitely fairly put on a lot of the international aid community is that at some point they started focusing very much at, on the one hand, easy wins, things that, you know, just could give them seemingly quick results and good targets, sometimes good things, and secondly, a soft focus on what they did in development, social sectors, health, education, and social protection, all good things for development. And that I would still think that any government in any countries, of course, should pay a lot of attention to. But actually not offering really a theory of change of how development and in the end large-scale poverty reduction is being delivered. And it's not ever delivered with short-term targets. It's not ever delivered only just focusing on the soft sectors. We do know, and we can just look at Asia and we can very quickly learn the lesson, the economy is the bedrock of creating the jobs and the livelihoods of the incomes. And it provides the resources that the state can keep on providing the social sectors. So one of the things that the economic development strategy wanted to do is to signal is that even as us as DFID as an organization, we should really pay enough attention to the areas of growth and development, the underlying engines of getting economies to develop. And I should emphasize, it's called an economic development strategy, but it had a strong focus on inclusion, that the nature of growth that creates jobs, that is of a high quality, that actually provides opportunities and good livelihoods for people, is an essential part. Just think of it. We spent with the MDGs, for example, an awful lot of attention to getting all these kids into school. It is also our responsibility internationally to make sure that resources are allocated and incentives are created, that the jobs can be created for these kids that we've all got to school, that we don't sit there simply with children with a lot of aspirations, but economies that are not functioning. And it was just repositioning ourselves that these things matter a lot.
Did it have any impact on how you allocated aid, that if you hadn't have had that strategy, things you wouldn't have done?
It's not going to change your portfolio overnight, but what it does is logging in that these kind of direction of travel will continue to be followed. In that sense, it's strategic, and in a government department, it locks in that that part of the organization is important. An example, it also led to internal reorganization and the emergence of a director general in charge of economic development. Now, that's quite important because it signals in the organization that also structurally, we are organizing ourselves that this remains a really important part of the way DFID will do its work. In the future, if another political leader comes that wants a different direction with DFID, if they want to change that, it's not just simply, oh, well, we rip up the document. It's embedded in the organization, and that would need to have changed. So I think that's probably the way it works more powerfully, sending a clear signal also to the world and also internally and within the way we operate, that we value that part of our work highly.
One of your long-term areas of interest has been planning for humanitarian aid. And as I understand it, your argument is the more planning you do, the better you can deliver that aid and the more accountable it is.
So it may sound a platitude to actually saying, oh, well, if you prepare a bit better, it will be better delivered. But it's very interesting to start from just the analysis of how an awful lot of humanitarian aid comes about and also how it is financed. One of the things that I found most shocking working inside an organization is that every time something big happened, a natural disaster or a new conflict broke out or a new refugee crisis, the way that the outward-facing, you know, benevolent part or the charitable part of the global community functioned is that rather than having somehow resources and you go to the bank and, you know, you arrange your resources a bit, we are going back to the 12th century. We are going back to the begging bowls. We are going to shout loudly and beg people, please come and help us. And I find it very peculiar because a big part of the development is funded by slow giving by people and, of course, within a government department by taxes, which is a simple way of people saying, look, I entrust you to gradually pay in here things and you do sensible things with it. And then suddenly, when the need is at its highest, we suddenly get rid of these systems and then we'll go begging. And of course, you have no control of how much money comes into it. There is no relationship between the money raised and the needs on the ground. And so we want to simply make the argument, if you want to be a rational decision maker, make sure that you clearly plan ahead what you would do in case of when there is a crisis. And why do you plan ahead? It's because then you can start thinking, if this event were to happen, how much money do I need? And you just rearrange your financial instruments in a way. You do essentially what an insurance company would do. If something unexpected happened, it knows where it will find the money to put in, and it knows via the contract who it will need to pay because there is an agreement made before, and this is what will happen if there is a drought. And it's very striking that that international system has nothing that actually would ever resemble how modern institutions that handle risk are organized. And so our appeal is simply is to rethink the way we organize these systems, but much more planning ahead with pre-agreed financing, and so that we take a little bit of this adrenaline and emotion and these begging aspects of it, but actually do this a bit more rational. And one of the things we know from the evidence is that a lot of humanitarian aid comes too late, and as a result, it's much less effective. It costs much more in the end to deal with it. Ebola is a beautiful example. It will have cost taxpayers in the UK, in the US, and in Europe $5 billion or more dollars to sort out the Ebola crisis, where if we had acted immediately when we knew the first cases, which was 6 months before it came in the news, probably cost us a couple of million dollars. Pre-agreed finance, knowing what you would do then, would have solved the problem. But we did have total limbo in decision making, no careful planning ahead, and then it ends up costing 13,131 lives and billions of dollars.
This idea of measuring at large scale tends to then move into the idea of this omniscient planner, top-down interventions all the time. can we learn things in a bottom-up way in this evidence-based environment?
Well, absolutely. And I'll come back to this example of humanitarian. You know, I was recently, so 2 years ago, quite involved in a drought in Ethiopia. The Ethiopian government is pretty capable, but outsiders came in and also setting all their systems up. It would be so much more sense that in countries like Ethiopia, where droughts can hit, Somalia, where there's a lull in the conflict and there's definitely places where one could build up systems, where one build up with communities, with local governments, with district authorities, whatever it is, when there is no crisis. And think about it. Suppose you have a drought. Suppose you have a particular crisis in your environment. Okay, what would be the best system that we then use to distribute it? We're setting, say, up social protection systems now with people there, with local government. When the crisis comes, the only thing we do is put some of our pre-agreed financing into it and actually make sure they can deliver. And that's definitely a very different model than it is now. Now it is very top down, say humanitarian, where the appeal will be issued by New York, by the UN. And then if the whole thing comes down, the global cavalry will come and save some people locally. No, no, you can actually build up these systems from below, but you need to do it beforehand.
Stefan Durkon, thank you very much. Thank you for listening to our podcast. For more podcasts from VoxDev, check out our website at voxdev.org.